So there are two loose heads just floating around in here somewhere?
You can hear them at night. They whisper to each other and then cry.
Since our host isn't here, would anyone care to mix me a drink?
Horror films ask us many questions. Who will survive and what will be left of them? Who's going to believe a talking head? What's blood for if not for shedding? Do you like scary movies? Have you checked the children? Maybe we'll find the answers together. Thank you for joining us on Photo Flow, Terror in the Smiles. Here are your hosts, Eric Jones and Jake Almond.
Good evening. I'm your host.
Welcome to Photo Flow. My name is Jake Almond. This is Eric Jones joining me.
Welcome back, everyone.
I don't know why I never introduce. That's why I have John introducing us in the intro. We also are going to bring in a special guest today because this is a movie that I love to pick on her about because she gets so passionate about it. And that's my wife, Heather Almond.
Hello.
And we are going to discuss, and these are Eric's picks for the week. Two classics. I'll let Eric introduce them and pick which one we're talking about first.
So after the heaviness of our prior episode, which was all Clive Barker, I needed a bit of a little bit of a horror palate cleanser. So I picked two old movies, two classics from the Universal Horror Library. We've already covered one Universal horror film earlier with we covered Frankenstein, but now we will be discussing 1931's Dracula, directed by Todd Browning, and then 1933's The Invisible Man, directed by Frankenstein director James Whale. So like I said, I needed
we covered on this show before.
Yep.
Because we talked about Frankenstein.
Yep. So yeah, I needed a bit of a palate cleanser after the weirdness of Hellraiser and Candyman.
Hey man, hey, you know what though? This was a good choice. I mean, because they're classics, they're fun, they still hold up. But there's some interesting stuff going on. Which one are we talking about first?
We can start with. I'll just flip a coin and my imaginary coin. we can start with The Invisible Man. That is my favorite. That's another reason why I wanted to do these. The Invisible Man is my favorite Universal of the classic Universal horror films. Dracula is my number two. So these are my two favorites of those. Of that era of films, but The Invisible Man, directed by James Whale, 1933. Claude Rains in his first role, and his first role was one that nobody could see him, at least not until the final moments.
I didn't realize that was his first.
Yeah,
I think what movie do you associate Claude Rains with? Other than The Invisible Man,
this would be probably Casablanca.
And, yeah, that's what I think of.
But and, Hitchcock's Notorious. Those are the my main two.
Okay, I didn't realize he was in Hitchcock movie. That's cool.
Oh yeah,
I haven't seen that one.
Notorious is great. Really, kind of underrated in a way. But definitely it's part of his Hollywood era, but before like his prime Hollywood era, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was your first memory of the concept of The Invisible Man? Was it this movie or was it one of the many, many other versions of it?
So I knew it was a book. I knew it was H.G. Wells's book. Same with like The War of the Worlds, because you know, as a kid, I was a sci-fi kid. I never read the book, but I knew of it, and I think the first Invisible Man thing that I knew of was John Carpenter's Memoirs of an Invisible Man. That was the first the first Invisible Man thing that I kind of knew about.
It's because it came out in like 92 and we were old enough to be aware of it.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't even know who Carpenter was then. That was just the first thing that I knew of. And then later on, I saw Paul Verhoeven's Hollow Man in theaters with Kevin Bacon. I
didn't realize Paul Verhoeven directed that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I remember my parents being excited to go see that, and they went without me on a date. And I was like, I didn't even care that much about it. And I didn't realize it was a Paul Verhoeven movie. That's great.
Yep. And then I saw that. And then there was this. This is actually one of those movies that I actually can't tie to renting it from the video store or something like that. I actually saw this. Halloween I was in college. I think I was like a freshman in college. And it was one of those rare moments we were off. I think it was because it was Columbus Day, but before everybody kind of like wised up about Columbus Day and all that. So I was off from school that day. I was at home at my parents' house, and Turner Classic Movies had on old horror movies. I'm just flipping through the channel. I come in about 20 minutes in, which the movie is only like an hour and 10 minutes, so that's a significant portion of it already. But
that's the really cool intro. That's like my favorite moment of the movie, is just him coming in that bar the first time.
Oh yeah, it's such a tone, you know, such a tone setter. And I was hooked on it all the way through. I was just really surprised at how tense and you know, how tense this movie was from the 30s. They did James Whale did a great job in kind of showing how Griffin is unhinged and how he gets more unhinged throughout. You genuinely feel like afraid of, you know, the fact that he's invisible and because he's losing it. And then, you know, it gets, you know, then he goes on a bit of a rampage, and that's also very effective. And, you know, that moment where he's like, he derails the train and all of that. And, you know, when he kills his former partner and all that, it's very, you know, it's all very well staged, very well shot. And the effects, which I watched the little documentary on the DVD all the time. And even I still can't figure out exactly how they pulled it off. I mean, I know they explain it, but that's just how good it is that I was like, wow, they're really able to do this in the 30s. You know,
it is impressive. When it ended, we watched it. We just rewatched it. And when it ended, I was like, you know, this is at a time when special effects weren't even really, you know, there weren't really that many special effects movies. And this was ahead of its time a little bit. I mean, you know, makeup effects and stuff, but this was like actual trickery, you know. I mean, I know that's been a part of film since the beginning, but I'm just saying, like, during this period of time, there weren't that many like spectacles. This was a spectacle as far as that goes.
Yeah, and it flowed really well. Like, a lot of the older movies that had the special effects, they were still kind of like glitchy, like almost like stop motion animation type thing. But this was like really seamless. Like when they're in the upstairs and he's walking across in his pajamas and like it's no head, no arms, you know, he's just walking across, and it's just very well done.
Well, comparing it, even to, as much as I love the movie, comparing it to Dracula, sometimes you see the seams and the strings, you know, but like with the Invisible Man, it was like, okay, they make you like in 1979 Superman or whatever, when they're like, you'll believe a man can fly. Well, you can believe a man is invisible in a 1933 film. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Heather, what was your first? I mean, were you aware of it before you know, you and I were watching these, or as a kid?
No. I mean, I think I had heard of The Invisible Man, but there were other things that, you know, like the memoirs. I remember hearing about the Chevy Chase movie. Obviously never saw it as a kid. But no, the first time I actually watched it was when we got the box set a few years ago and started watching through them.
Yeah. And see, I can remember being kind of thrown off by it to be on, like, same for me. My memory is the same as Heather's as far as that goes. I had never seen the original. I had seen parts of it. I had seen the famous scene where he takes the bandages off and throws his nose at them and all that. But I had never seen it all the way through until we watched it together a few years ago. And for me, Dracula, I love, because I like vampire stuff. And then I love the Wolfman. To me, the Wolfman's probably my all-time favorite. I love the performances and the sadness in that movie. The Invisible Man kind of threw me off because I'm used to, and Frankenstein, of course, is a stone cold classic. It's beautiful. But the Invisible Man threw me off because I'm used to the Universal monsters having kind of, you can have kind of sympathy for them. And I feel like this dude's a bastard. Like, there's not a lot of sympathy to be had for him. He's really unhinged. And my question when we were watching it together most recently was he always a bastard? Was he maybe just an egomaniac and was it the drugs that made him invisible that changed his personality? I mean, what was your interpretation? Because Heather and I had slightly different interpretations. I think she just assumed he was just always the only reason he hadn't been committing murders up to this point was because he wasn't invisible. Like, she thinks that he used it as an excuse.
I think you are who you are. And when you are given unlimited power, it shows your true colors.
But
I don't think that changes who you are. Like, chemical substances can absolutely change who you are. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying, like, I think your soul is your soul. And
I feel like he was just an egomaniac. What do you think, Eric?
He was a narcissist.
Yeah, so I've always, like, I know in, so when I've read up on the original book, in the book they claim He was just always a terrible person, even before he went invisible, if I remember that correctly. But so, like, in the movie, how they kind of like how his fiance's father explains how one of the chemicals he uses was used on a dog, and it drove the dog mad. I can believe. I mean, yeah, based on the fact that his mission was just to make himself invisible, I can believe that maybe he might not, it drove him to the point where he would eventually, well, I don't know. See, when he's in there in the study, when he reveals himself, reveals in air marks to himself to Dr. Kemp, and he was like, an invisible man can rule the world. And he was like, no one will see him come. No one will see him go. He's like, he can rob and rape and kill. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, that is kind of interesting how, like, that is what you kind of, you know, thought of. Like, you know, it's just kind of interesting. I don't think that it's kind of interesting to think that, you know, would the drugs kind of lead his mind to thinking that that is something that he could do? It's kind of like, maybe it probably might have been something that's in his mind, you know, from the start. So yeah, it's. I think the film tries to say, "Hey, it's all the drugs." But yeah, I think that as you watch, you know, and if you listen to the dialogue, you'll kind of think that, you know, maybe it's one of those things where he wouldn't do it because he knows he could be seen doing it, but since when he got the power, he did sort of, you know, he did do a lot of those things. He did go around killing people and harassing people and stuff like
that. I mean, like, he threw a baby, like,
yeah.
Like, come on, dude.
Well, it's shocking. It's actually kind of shocking how many, I mean, granted, most of the deaths are off screen, but when you really consider, like, he kills hundreds of people in this movie. I was telling Heather last night, I said, I'm pretty sure he racks up a higher body count in this one movie than Freddy Krueger does in the entire Elm Street series. Like, he's just murdering entire trains of people, you know? It's pretty crazy. Like, there's not a lot of redemption for him, but I feel like at the end, they almost still try a little bit to make you feel sorry for him, but I don't feel
like. Well, they threw the girl in to, like, offer some type of sympathy. Nah, she's got poor taste in men.
Which is one thing that the new one kind of did well.
Well, the music at the end of the movie, I pointed this out, was that throughout the entire movie, the music had been really ominous and kind of, like, dark, you know? It had that beat that was just kind of, it was kind of like a train. It just kept getting more ominous and more ominous. And then at the end, when he, you know, the chemicals wear off or whatever, and he gets his form back and he's laying there dead. It was like this really sweet, happy music. Like he was laying there peaceful.
I just feel like there was only so many ways that movie music was used though back in those days.
But that was really bad. Yeah. Like, it should have been, if anything, it should have been like a...
Well, at least it wasn't like 10 years earlier in the silent era, and God knows what anyone in whatever theater piano player would be playing. They would just pull some random sheet music and play it.
Yeah.
Captown Races, sing this song.
That's actually really interesting with the music, because, you know, during that time, the rule is that, you know, anyone who commits any sort of crime, you know, they got to be, you know, they got to be held accountable at the end. And it is kind of interesting that this kind of, you know, in a way sort of lets him off the hook. Like, you know, he dies, but yeah, like you said, the music kind of gives you this feeling that, like, okay, well, you know, he's absolved a little bit of,
like, he's of suddenly he's at peace now, like, we should care.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like it should have been more of a cautionary tale.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
I mean, it's a great movie, though. It still holds up. It feels somehow, like, in a way that, like, Dracula to me doesn't really feel short, even though it's super short. And The Wolfman, like, all these original Universal movies are very, very short. This one feels like it's shorter somehow. Like I'm kind of wanting to see more. Like, it left me wanting more, which I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying that's pretty cool. The way Heather pointed out when we were watching it, it just throws you into it. Like, you don't see his origin story. You just something's not right with him. Obviously, you know, the title of the movie is The Invisible Man, but let's just say you were watching it randomly, had no clue what was going on. It just throws you in, and the opening scene really sets up, like you said, it's this, there's a bit of a dramatic weight to it from the very start. And I think what's really interesting is I did watch The Memoirs of the Invisible Man yesterday, and then turned around last night and watched the 2020 Invisible Man. And both of those kind of do similar, where they just throw you into it. Whereas, well, the only difference is The Memoirs does go back and tell the story. He's kind of telling you what all happened. And I don't know how much of that is drawn from the book, but he's more sympathetic. Like the Chevy Chase one, like, you want him to, you know,
well, he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right, right. He's kind of a yuppie doofus, but yeah. he's not like a...
He's not evil.
Right. Whereas the guy in the original comes across like evil, and the guy in the 2020 one is a total psychopath. So,
and I was... and even in... I would say that in Hollow Man, Kevin Bacon's character is a bit more... I say he might be a bit more in line with... Claude Rains' character. You kind of see him from the start as being, you know, as, you know, jackass obsessive scientist, and like you said, over time he just ends up getting worse and worse. I'd say that Hollow Man probably might be the closest in characterization, but from the start in Hollow Man, you know Kevin Bacon is an ass anyway throughout the whole film from start to finish anyway.
Yeah. No, but I mean, I think that's probably accurate. Like, when Hollow Man came out, obviously it's pretty obvious that it's an Invisible Man movie, but because it doesn't use that title, I didn't know that it was gonna really follow pretty closely to the storyline, or what, you know, like a new take on it, but it sticks pretty close to the characterization. And it's funny, like, watching, like, I've never seen any of the other Universal Invisible Men, like the old Universal, because they made sequels, which is crazy considering he dies at the end. But I don't know if they're retconning anything, or if it's a different guy that becomes the Invisible Man. But I didn't realize there were so many sequels to all these, you know, classic Universal characters until later on. But when I was watching Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, which is fantastic. Fantastic movie. At the very, very end, there's like they do like a Marvel thing where there's like a teaser for what they're gonna do next, and it's the Invisible Man is in it at the end. And I'm like, is that supposed to be the same one that died in the first one, or is that a different Invisible Man?
Yeah. There is. I've seen the sequels. There is somewhat of a tie. Like kind of like with like the Frankenstein sequels, how they'll just be like, oh, this is so and so's long distance uncle or something like that.
Oh, okay. So is it like, so in the new one, in the 2020 one, it's him and his brother. So is it a brother in the first sequel?
Because the first sequel was The Invisible Man Returns.
That would be cool if it was the brother, because that would make the 2021.
I gotta get this book now.
Yeah, it was it was like a brother or something like that. Yeah, in the first one, in the first sequel, The Invisible Man Returns, it was Griffin's brother.
Who now has the
serum.
So they kind of pulled that with the 2021 then, because wasn't his name Griffin in the new one too?
Yep.
It was, okay. So that's kind of neat. And they do something, and I won't spoil it because that movie's still kind of fresh. I won't spoil it. But they do something different with that one than I didn't expect. Whereas in the original, it's much more of a mad scientist type thing. But that's cool. I'll have to check those out. I need to get the sequels. Like, I know that I've heard there's some good Frankenstein sequels and even some good, and Heather and I watched the daughter of, was Dracula's daughter or something?
Yeah,
Dracula. That was kind of fun.
It was good. It was actually very good. But you were, just to go back for just a second, you had asked me what my first Invisible Man thing was. Okay, so the first time I became aware.
Don't say Jesus.
Jake. No. DuckTales. DuckTales did an entire thing on monster movies, and Hotel Strange Duck was the 13th episode of DuckTales.
How did you know that off the top of your head? Wow. I wasn't even looking that up.
it was their version of The Invisible Man, but then they went through and they did the Ducky Horror Show. Right, and it actually did like Bride of Frankenstein and Wolfman and The Mummy, and it was like their version.
I remember The Mummy, that
those.
Was famous. That was in the
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How do you remember the episode?
Oh no, I looked that up.
Okay, you didn't look it up just now.
I did. I looked it up like 10
you
minutes ago.
Should have just hid that phone and not showed totally that. I was impressed. I was like, wow.
I was gonna say like I can name a favorite Star Trek episode. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what season and what. episode number it was.
Well, I just thought if anybody loves DuckTales like I love DuckTales, they could go back and look at episode 13. But yep. Yeah, that so I was, and a lot of things did that. You know, well, Looney Tunes did certain things too.
Oh yeah.
To parody those monster movies, and I think that was probably my first experience with that.
I remember Looney Tunes did a lot of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde stuff. I'm sure they did something with invisibility at some point.
You know, that was such... Okay, so this is going to turn into Looney Tunes for just a moment. They did a lot of literary things that introducing kids to classic books, classical music, all kinds of things. And I have students now, you know, I teach music at a local music studio. And I have students come in and they'll be learning a new song on cello or violin. I'm like, oh, you'll recognize this song. And they play it and I'm like, do you know what that's from? And they're like, no, I've never heard this ever. And I'm like... You didn't see Bugs Bunny play this? And they're like, who's Bugs Bunny? And I about die. I'm like, what is wrong with these kids? That's
funny. Well, it's like, what was it? The Seinfeld episode where Elaine says, Jerry, it's sad that everything you know about high culture comes from comes from Bugs Bunny.
But it's true. And like our kids are suffering, y'all. Bring back Looney Tunes.
Moving on to what was I gonna say? I was gonna mention somebody that Eric and I follow on Twitter, actually a friend of the show, and I don't have his name right in front of me. Eric, you know who I'm talking about. You guys have podcasted together.
I'm sorry, but I don't
have my phone in front of me.
I'm assuming you're I would assume you'll probably be talking about friend of the show Dave Babbitt. At 24 panels.
Yes.
Yep.
So I was talking about the Invisible Man last night, and he posted something really cool. This actually goes back to when we were doing Waxing Cinematic and we were covering Batman the Animated Series, but there's an episode of Batman the Animated Series about a guy who is working on a suit that can make him invisible, and he has a daughter in that episode, and he's also he's apparently a crazy person. He's the bad guy in the episode, so Batman's after him. But his wife is trying to figure out a way to get away from him with her daughter. And do you know who the daughter is in the episode? Who does the voice of the little girl?
Is it Elizabeth Moss by any chance?
Elizabeth Moss, who played in the 2020 Invisible Man.
Oh, that's wild.
And she's the little girl, and her mom's trying to get away from the Invisible Man, and Batman's trying to solve the mystery and everything. It's pretty wild. Wow,
that episode doesn't ring a bell. I'm have to check that back out, because that episode doesn't ring a bell to me.
I've watched it, but I don't think we ever covered it on. We never got to it on the Essentials.
Oh, okay.
But yep, that's pretty cool.
Wow.
All right, so I feel like every single kid, whether they ever saw any of the movies or not, knew the name Dracula, like from birth. You just know the name Dracula.
Well, they've seen it in everything. I mean, Daffy Duck has played Dracula. There was Dracula on DuckTales.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I mean, like, even if they didn't, you go into Walmart at Halloween and there's like 10 versions of a Dracula costume.
Count Chocula.
Exactly. I mean,
Count Duckula.
Yeah. There's so many Dracula movies too. Like, there's so many of them out there. Like, I think you and I, Heather, have watched like at least 50 different Dracula movies, and there's still Dracula.
Oh, and we still have more to watch.
Yeah, it's so crazy. So what was your, Eric, what was your first memory of Dracula, like earliest memory of
Just Dracula in general, or like the movie?
Yeah, like what was your first like understanding of it, I guess?
Yeah, I guess probably, like as Heather was saying, Looney Tunes, because there was a Looney Tunes cartoon where Bugs goes to Transylvania, and he is, and you know, he's going back and forth with this vampire. I don't remember if he specifically says he's Dracula, but you know, just the idea of big scary castle, nighttime, guy transforms into bat. Wants to drink blood, you know. So that, I think that's probably my like earliest memory of the concept. And then there was also the cartoon Count Duckula, which used to come on Nickelodeon. That was another early instance. And I think probably the first time I learned, like really began to understand, like Dracula as a whole, as a literary concept and all that, was probably during the release of Francis Ford Coppola's, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula. That was probably the first time where it was like, now, because now I'm, you know, I'm a little bit older, I'm, you know, I'm understanding media as a whole now, and I think that was probably the first instance where it's like, oh, okay, now that I'm, you know, I'm older, this is what like Dracula is about.
Well, what was the first vampire fiction you ever, like, not related or just vampire in general? Was there anything that you saw before you ever saw a Dracula film?
None that I could think of. I think the Universal Dracula is the, actually, you know what? No, I'm sorry. The first vampire-related thing that I definitely remember watching was Blade, the Marvel Blade with Wesley Snipes. That's probably the first vampire film that I remember. And then
Blade was great.
And then I think Dracula wasn't in the first Blade. I think he doesn't show up until the third one or something like that.
Blade, I never saw the third one.
I saw it once, and I know it's not everyone's favorite, and I've only seen it the one time. But and then there was there was another movie, like a Dracula 2000 or something like that.
Oh yeah, Wes Craven produced it. Yeah. Oh,
okay.
And the editor I know the first two, maybe the first three Scream movies, Patrick Lussier, he directed it.
Yeah, but I think the first, then the actual first thing based on Bram Stoker's Dracula, the book I saw was the 1931 Universal film. I remember I was in high school. I worked for the library, Free Library of Philadelphia. It had this after school program and just help kids out with their homework, show them computer stuff and do projects with them and stuff like that. And I remember the library is the best free video store. So I just, I rented it there because it was just there. So I remember just renting the VHS and I had never read it, but I was just really surprised at how atmospheric it was. I wouldn't read the book until like my senior year of high school. And so I really don't, I won't say I'm.
Did you have to read it for school or was that just out of your
mind? We had to read it for school. And that, because we read it and then they showed us the Coppola film. That was my immediate exposure kind of then. And I always said I kind of maybe need to give the book another another read, just so that I have, because I'm far more familiar with these films now than I ever was with
not being in high school anymore makes a difference sometimes too.
Yeah,
when you're forced to read something for school versus on your own. See, for me, I never had to read it. I think the scariest book I read in school was The Lord of the Flies.
Which I did not have to read.
Yeah, I had to read that. And but I mean, I was always, for me, the first vampire thing I ever saw that I loved it and I still do, is The Lost Boys. Like, that was a favorite of mine growing up. I loved
never saw
it.
That.
And that was my vampire story. Like, I loved it. And so Dracula was just like pop culture, same thing you guys were talking about, cartoons and stuff. And I always thought it was gonna, I remember seeing images of Bela Lugosi as Dracula because it's so iconic, right? So you had to see it around Halloween, but I never watched the movie. But everybody would like, I want to suck your blood, you know, which is not even how he, it's not even something that he does, you know, in the movie. But what was your first exposure to it, Heather?
Well, it was definitely the cartoons when I was little. And then I remember TCM would play movies, you know, around Halloween. I wasn't really allowed to watch Halloween movies because I wasn't allowed to participate in Halloween activities. But I do recall watching part of Dracula on TV when I knew I wasn't going to get caught. And then as I got older, I read the Sookie Stackhouse novels, the Charlene Harris novels, the Southern Vampire series. And those were really good. And then they made the show. And then, you know, I just started becoming more interested in all the different types of vampire stories out there. But Dracula, once I picked up the book and read it, I was like, okay, this is canon. I love this.
She's been so difficult.
This is so great.
I remember being, she was so excited about it. And we both loved the Bela Lugosi one. We watched it probably more than
any. And it is my favorite. Like, out of all the ones I've seen, that one's my favorite, even though it is not like the book.
Hold on one second. We're under attack.
He can stay.
Like, someone just kicked in the door.
It's the door.
The door was locked too. Like, I don't know how they got the door.
No, it wasn't completely shut. That's why when Ryan came out here saying, I mean, I'm sure all that got picked up on tape. But anyway.
Sorry, y'all. Backstory, we have 4 kids, 2 dogs, and 2 cats living in this house. And it can be a circus sometimes.
So. Yeah. And her mom was like, Leonard came in, our dog came in the door, and her mom, Heather's mom, tried to grab the door. And see, we're still. Update for the people that have been following along. We're still not in our house.
Y'all, we're so far away.
They bought paint today.
Oh, they good for paint. Them.
Yep. And they ordered the floors. Floors. But anyway, I'm not going to get caught up into that.
Talk about sucking your blood. Yeah. Contractors.
Yep. So, So when Heather read the book, she became on fire about Dracula. So I had to download. I think I was still commuting to work pre-pandemic, 4 days a week, hour drive, an hour home. So I went through the book in the audiobook really quick, and it was cool. I enjoyed it, and I was like, yeah, that's great. The Bela Lugosi Dracula became a favorite. We watched it at least once a year around Halloween, and it's something that I can watch with the kids. I haven't shown it to Ben and Sam yet. They're still a little young, but I don't think they would sit through it. But Ryan and Quinn, that was one of their first horror movies, both of them. And last year or the year before, we watched it with my parents. We set up the screen outside and watched it with them. That was fun. On the big screen.
Yeah, we watched that in Wolfman.
Kind of like a drive-in type thing. And so I was so excited because I remembered the Francis Ford Coppola one too, like Eric said. That and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein that Kenneth Branagh did came out around the same time, and I liked both of them. So I was like, Heather, you're going to really like Francis Ford Coppola's because it's cool, and it's an homage to the 1930s Dracula, and it's just so cool. You're going to love it. She hated that movie so much. she acted angry about it.
Oh, I hated it.
It's really
It's
a great movie.
It is a...
No. Well, I mean, I had told her about how Coppola had used to read it to his... he used to be like a camp counselor or something, and he would read it to his
he needs to reread it. Like,
I don't agree with you. I think that there's a lot of the stuff that he pulls from is there, but it's not, it's in the subtext. It's not.
Okay, so if it would have been Francis Ford Coppola's,
it is,
instead of Bram Stoker's,
it is. Friend, stop hitting the table. You're sorry, picking up on the mic.
So
she's so passionate.
If they would have left the author's name out of it and it would just been his version of it, I would have been completely fine with that. Because I love Dracula's stories, and I'm really not that hard on any of them but this one. And I'm like, how can a fan who talks about how he loves the book so much and he's going to convert the book into the movie, and then he did that?
That's one of his most, you got The Godfather 1 and 2, The Conversation, Apocalypse Now, and Dracula. Those are his top five.
But this was supposed to be his love child. Like he loved the book so much he wanted to make a movie about it, and then he completely,
he didn't completely anything. I mean, there are things in the...
He combined characters, cut characters. Okay. It was stupid.
Okay, but what about the Jack Palance Dracula? Remember that one?
Yes.
that was bad, too.
It was bad, but in a very endearing...
No.
What good did you, chuckle way.
See, she didn't even like the Christopher Lee Dracula, which the horror of Dracula. That was good. I thought that was good. He's great as Dracula.
Well, okay, so when you sit down and you say, I want you to compare this to the book, when I compare it to the book, yeah, I don't like it. But on its own, it's fun.
I think my first memory, actually, of seeing a Dracula movie was just one scene of the Christopher Lee one. It wasn't even the Bela Lugosi one. It was the scene where, I just remember the cross and him recoiling from the cross, and that's all I really, really remember. But I haven't seen any of the other Christopher Lee Dracula movies except for the first one. Mm-hmm. Eric, outside of Bela Lugosi, what was your?
Bela Lugosi is actually on one. Hammer Films is actually one area where I am deficient in. I haven't seen pretty much any Hammer film, so I need that's a blind spot that I need to
I need to get in on the Frankenstein stuff. The Frankenstein Hammer stuff looks really cool. I've been wanting to get more into that. Back to the subject of the episode though. As far as Dracula goes, just like with the Invisible Man, one of the things that strikes me about it every time is that, granted, they can't go quite as far as they can now, of course, but there's still a genuine creepiness to it. Like the scene, there's a lot of off-screen deaths of children and stuff like that. That the wives and all that stuff. There's a scene where they where it's heavily implied and I believe revealed that they murdered a kid or whatever, and that these kids are going missing throughout the town. And that part of the film is pretty intense. There's something really creepy about it.
Yeah, they got that. Right, for sure. If you're comparing it to the book.
But there's something about Renfield too that always works for me in that version that I don't think necessarily is always done well in other versions. And what do you think about the character of Renfield in Dracula? Is it camp? Is it, I mean, what do you think of it, Eric?
That's interesting. Because I love the opening and how, like I said, how creepy and foreboding it is. See, I don't necessarily go into camp. I think camp is almost like intentional. I just think that Dwight Fry, you know, Renfield's just supposed to be, you know, going insane or whatever. I think that's just how he just happens to portray it. But like, I mean, it's very effective, especially when they're saying that, like, he was, you know, he's eating spiders and flies and stuff like that. So it's a very effective performance. I always kind of giggle in the beginning when they're on their way to he's like, oh, I'm going up to Castle Dracula, and everybody's just looking at him like, wait, so you're going back out after midnight? And I love when he gets to the pass, the carriage driver just like throws his luggage out and just and hauls the S off. I just love that.
No, that's actually really, really good. They set it up like, okay, this is not a place where any sane person wants to be. I think Dwight Fry's performance is good, man. I mean, I think that it's easy to laugh at it because the way he's like laughing at, like, you, there's something, he seems like he's seen, you know, doing a little bit of scenery chewing, but it was also the acting style at the time. I mean, we are just into talkies at this point, and the acting style is going to be a little more from the stage, you know, like theater.
Yeah, he did come from the stage too.
Yeah, and there's a bit of the theatrical qualities to his acting. The performance, what's your favorite performance in the movie outside of Bela Lugosi? I mean, obviously he's iconic, but like, is there anybody that sticks out to you?
I love Edward Van Sloan as Van Helsing. Just because he's just so ridiculously confident, and how he kind of just like when he whips out the cross or whatever and Dracula, like, you know, hauls ass out of there, and how he just sort of just stands there just all badass for being an old man.
You know, there's something about his performance that makes that, I think if you're going to have a character like Van Helsing, you need him to kind of give you comfort in a situation. Like, if you were in that situation where you were facing a Dracula, who would you want in that room with you to protect you? And I think he has that kind of presence. And there's always been something about his performance that I've loved because it's a little bit understated, and that's something that you don't get in movies from 1931. There's something about him, like I was saying, Dwight Fry is very theatrical, and there's something kind of understated about Edward Van Sloan that almost feels like a modern performance. And I think that's pretty cool because the contemporary character that I draw to Van Helsing that I love is Father Merrin in The Exorcist. And there's something about the performance of oh my goodness, I knew my brain was gonna crap out on me. The guy who plays Father Merrin in The Exorcist, he played in all the Swedish films.
Max
von Sydow.
Okay, his performance in that is like the Van Helsing in there. You know, he's kind of that confidence and sure of himself and grandfatherly and comforting, but he's also, well, Max von Sydow is very understated as an actor too. And I think that there's something very cool going on in that performance. And I think Edward Van Sloan gives a similar performance in the 1931 Exorcist. I mean, in the 1931 Exorcist, the 1931 Dracula. And there's something about those two characters that, in my brain anyway, like, I like them for the same reasons. And I always think of Father Merrin when I think of Van Helsing in this movie. specifically. There's something about him and Max von Sydow that remind me of, like, their performances remind me of each other. Not in a bad way either. Like, I don't think that there was any inspiration on Max's part. I just think that that's his acting style. But there is something about those two characters that, and I think those two characters in fiction serve a similar purpose.
So, well, they're very calm.
Yeah.
They're very calm and collected, and they feel like they're in charge, and because they're so quiet and they're confident, I guess, you feel like, okay, this is the person that we can look to because they're thinking things through.
Well, they know what they're dealing with from the moment they come on the screen. Okay, everybody else is like freaking out and not sure what to do. And they both have the answers, like, okay, we're dealing with a vampire, or okay, we're dealing with a demon, you know, like, whatever the case is.
Well, I mean, Van Helsing in the beginning, though, and Dracula didn't. Like, he actually traveled back and forth and had advisors and had to leave. Do you remember he had to leave them? And everybody's like, you're leaving us?
Yeah.
And he actually left.
Right. He's kind of an investigator.
Yeah.
I'm just saying there's something about their performances that I love, and this type of storyline, you kind of need a character like that, because you, I don't know, there's something very, it's like a warm blanket with both of them, and that's what I liked about it.
Yeah, no, I would agree that, yeah, that's it, a performance like that is kind of, yeah, kind of like what makes you feel safe. I guess you could almost kind of take that in The Invisible Man a little bit also with his Griffin's fiance's father, not quite, but you know, sort of similar to that vein. Now, one thing that I kind of have to get when I rewatch, one thing I'll kind of have to pay closer attention to. I always kind of focus really heavy on Dracula and Van Helsing whenever I watch this, but I never pay as close attention to like Mina and Lucy, and that's something I know I got to do.
Those characters get shortchanged in most
movies. They get very shortchanged,
except from the Coppola Dracula. I feel like I wish you could see her face.
First, you're wrong.
Look, Lucy, that scene in Coppola's Dracula where she is like all demonic and pale and in that dress and she vomiting blood, that shit was awesome. That was like straight off of a heavy metal album. It was great. I loved it. I love that, and I love the cross catching fire, and I love the demon bat form that Dracula takes. It's pretty cool. Some good stuff in that movie.
Everything in the movie wasn't bad. But there were a lot of things that I'm just like, why? There were things changed that didn't need to be changed. And I'm not saying every single thing needed to be added in the movie. If you tried to fit every single thing out of the novel into a movie, you would have like
a ridiculously long movie. Well, the novel is just letters written back and forth.
Too, right. So. Yeah, exactly. But there are certain things that I feel like are important. And
yeah. Well, when you combine characters, you drop characters. And
see, that was one of the things I think that
how do you feel in the 1931
movie? I feel like it came the closest to having the relationships right.
Right. But in the 1931 film, there was still some of that combining things and dropping things. And I feel like where if I was going to be critical, which it's a classic film, so it doesn't matter. But I'm not trying to be a critic, but I'm just saying I feel like if there's one part of the 1931 film, the ending isn't as strong as the beginning. Like the beginning, that opening, everything with Harker going to meet at Dragon's Castle, all that stuff's iconic. Dracula at the top of the stairs, all those shots are iconic. But the very ending is, I never remember it. Like I never remember, every time I watch it almost every year, I'm just like, oh, okay, yeah, that happens. It's never, like there's nothing really that's great about the ending of the movie for me. But everything at the beginning, let's cut that out. Everything at the beginning and everything with Van Helsing figuring it out and the mirror, the scene with the mirror and all that, you know, all that stuff is amazing.
Well, I feel like the 1931, it took the basic idea of Dracula and it took a lot of good things from the book, but it didn't try too hard. And I think that's what makes it charming to me. It's like a synopsis. And it was done very well. And I think that's why I like it, because they didn't try to combine too many things and keep certain things from the novel in while combining certain characters. They didn't have to rewrite stuff. They just took it out completely. And I would rather see that happen than, you know.
Yeah. Eric, what would be your thoughts on it? Like, beyond that, like,
yeah, I definitely would agree about the ending. And the funny thing about the ending, I watched it with the commentary on. And so at the very end, when Van Helsing, when he stakes Dracula, and you hear those moans from Lugosi, they had lost those sounds, actually, for a good long while. Like, they had it in 31 when it came out, but I mean, and you know how film goes over the years, they had lost those sounds. So for many years, whenever the movie would replay, you don't hear anything. There's nothing. It's just, you know, he gets the stake, and then there's that cut to I guess when the spell is no longer over, Mina, she and Harker kind of just walk up the stairs, and that's the end. And I think that is probably also why the ending probably doesn't hit, because this film has no score. And so when it's over, it's like, oh, wow. Like, you know, you have that little bit of Swan Lake in the opening, over the credits in the beginning, but there's no score there. And by the time it's done, when that, it's just, oh, they're walking. Oh, wow, that's it. You know,
and that was because it was literally walking the line between a talkie and a silent film.
Yes, right? It was actually filmed so that it could be a silent film for certain theaters. They didn't have the capabilities of doing talkies. And this is an interesting throwback to Candyman that y'all just did. Philip Glass did the music for Candyman. And so I started looking into Philip Glass music because that It Was Always You, Helen theme. I just love it. And so I got it for piano and I've been playing it. So I started looking at other things that he's done, and I came across Dracula, and I was like, what in the world? I was like, what version did he write music for? And then I started listening to it, and I was like, this sounds like really old music. So I started doing some research on it. And Philip Glass was actually hired by a studio to go in and write an entire score for the silent version of the 1931 Dracula. So you can turn it on and you can play this score with it all the way to the end. And it plays like a silent movie with the piano playing.
Like, if you sync it.
And he wrote all the music for it.
And I was like, man, how cool. Like, it was on, it was just on one VHS copy, right, that Universal put out?
I'm not sure about that.
I think it was in the 90s.
But you can get the soundtrack. It's on Apple Music.
Yeah, it's probably on Spotify and Apple Music, too. But the thing about that is, you could probably totally, especially since we've seen this movie, all of us have seen this movie multiple times, you could probably totally do that. You would be missing the silent movie version, I'm assuming, had title cards, though. Title cards in between, like, for dialogue.
Probably.
But the version that we all have is the talkie version. That's cool, though. We should do that. That would be fun. Now, the only alternate version that I know of that's on the DVD or the Blu-rays that we have, and I think Eric's seen it before, he could speak on it, is the Spanish version. And I've never watched that version.
It's very good. It's actually a bit longer than the American version, and it's they filmed on the same, they would use like the same sets and all that. The only difference was that the Spanish crew had to work at night, but they would have all the cues and all the setups and any sort of storyboards that were left over from the English crew when they would work during the day. So when you when you take a moment and you watch the Spanish version, I love this one. The Spanish version is actually kind of a lot better filmed, because they would take what was left over. But yeah, it's very good, and the cast is very good as well. Like I said, it's just a little, it's a little bit longer. Actually, well, this one's like 1 hour 10 minutes, and I think the Spanish one was like 1 hour 40 or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they got quite a bit.
So was the script originally longer, and they just cut a lot of stuff out? You think?
That's why I have to. That's why I have to look up. I don't think it did. I can't remember. Yeah, no, yeah, you know, because I don't think they used the same script actually.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think they used the other. Yeah, I don't think they used the same script.
That's.
But yeah, it was very. Yeah, it was very. It's very good.
It's cool that Universal includes that, because that seems like something that could have been lost to time easily.
Yeah, yeah, like the fact that, because I picked up before I got the Blu-ray set of Dracula, which is the only Universal monster set that I got on Blu-ray. But I had this, it was just this regular DVD, and it had Dracula, Frankenstein, Wolfman, and I think The Mummy. And I didn't realize it was a bonus feature on there. And I was like, oh, wow. Most of the time I'm used to like Criterion Collection being the only one where you get like a bonus movie or something. But yeah, would they include that on there? And I was like, wow. So that means they, Universal really feels it as part of, you know, part of its history. So that's always good to see.
Yeah, I'm going to check that out.
So apparently with the soundtrack that Philip Glass wrote, he was given the option of doing Dracula, The Mummy, or Frankenstein. And he chose Dracula because it never had an actual score. It just had, like Eric said, an excerpt from Swan Lake and then a couple other classic songs, but they were never whole pieces of music.
Yeah, they were like more like they were just placeholder music.
Yeah, he actually did a string quartet and piano. So you've got all that, and it's very 19th century sounding. And that's why when I heard it, I was like, oh wow, this sounds like music from that era that the movie was.
It's interesting.
So, yeah, it's really neat.
I might have to watch it that way and the Spanish language version.
Yeah, when you watch the Spanish one, you'll be really surprised. Like, their staging is superb. Like, there are times I'm watching and I'm like, wow, this is much, because they were basically using what the American crew already would leave behind. So they would use that opportunity to be like I believe they said they could even view the dailies. So that they would be like, okay, well, this is what they did. Here's what we could do to make our shot look better.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. You know, I wonder what Dracula would have looked like if, and I mean, it's not badly shot. There's some really good shots in there, but I wonder what Dracula would have looked like if James Whale had directed it. Cause there's something about, I think, James Whale's direction that's more atmospheric and less static or something.
No, I would agree. Like Todd Browning was a capable director. The other main film that I think a lot of people are probably known for is Freaks, and that is also a very
that's an important film in horror. We could cover that sometime.
Yeah, but the funny thing is the cinematographer for Dracula was Carl Freund, or Freund, I'm not sure if I'm saying it correctly, but he would then go on to direct The Mummy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so.
I mean, there's something about the way, and I think it was probably just because they probably, a lot of these guys probably came from theater, and this is still early in film. There's something about Dracula, the American version, that's shot kind of like a stage play. And
well, it was the film is actually the film is based on the 1924 stage play, which is the theatrical adaptation of the novel. So the film is an adaptation of a play that was the adaptation of the novel.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. And that actually accounts for a lot. So, but there's something about the way that James Whale directs Frankenstein and The Invisible Man that he moves the camera a lot. And like Bride of Frankenstein's even, I mean, there's actually like Frankenstein especially, there's some genuinely striking, beautiful images, like cinematic language going on in that movie. And it's very effective. And a lot of it is the editing, but he does move the camera in an interesting way. Like there's just a lot of atmosphere in it. And we talked about it on the episode, you know, one of our first episodes, actually. But I'm not saying Browning's direction's not good. It's just, it is different. But, I mean, it's not bad. It totally works here, and it's an iconic film. I mean, we're not going to sit here and be like, you know, this movie from 1931 that we're still watching is garbage. Obviously, there's something to it, you know. But yeah, it's just interesting. It's just kind of like what ifs. But yeah, I mean, I think that you got to give it a lot of credit for being a movie that was early on in film. There wasn't a lot to draw from. Maybe Nosferatu was like the only other adaptation that existed before this, and then you had what Heather was saying, where they're having technological, like, down, like some parts of the country have theaters that don't even have the ability to do sound and do a talkie. And some people still think talkie is a gimmick, sort of like how people treat 3D or motion, or like 4D theaters now, you know, where, you know, you go and the seats move and stuff during the show. I mean, like, all these things are kind of gimmicks to try to draw people in for a different experience, you know? And people thought the same thing about talkies at the time. So a lot of people thought talkies would not last. Like, nobody really cared. And that wasn't how you shot movies. Like, it was a musical and visual experience only. And so I give Todd Browning and everybody else a lot of credit, I think, from a film historical perspective, just because it does work very well I could see how it would work either way, and I think that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it works. I mean, I love it. We'll watch it again this Halloween, I'm sure.
Yeah, and also something to put into perspective, like a timeline. The book was written in 1897. And the movie was made in 1931. That's not a whole lot of time.
I thought it was written way before then.
Yeah, 1897 was when the book was released. So you're looking at about 33 years, something like that.
Yeah. Well, then and Nosferatu came out even before that, mm-hmm. which was when did Nosferatu come out? Like 1915 or something. I don't know. I mean, yeah. So the story was. I mean, you think of a book that's 30 years old now that, you know, that you could still...
1922.
Okay, 1922, yeah. I mean, think of there are books that are 30 years old now that you could, if they hadn't already been adapted, that you could totally, like, oh yeah, people would love this as a movie. So yeah, I mean, I could see Dracula still being, I mean, the fact that it got two film adaptations in the early, early days of cinema... is impressive. It was a good book. All right. Well, I don't really have anything else to say about it, man.
No.
You got to go. So.
Yeah, no. Just that it's a great... Both of these movies, both great instances of the universal horror. And I'm hoping that after with the 2020 Invisible Man, I'm hoping that's what they keep doing. I hope they keep doing some sort of like modern day reinvention of a lot of these stories.
Yeah, that one's good. You know, I'd love to see somebody really just do a great Creature from the Black Lagoon. I don't know why I've been able to do that.
That would be fantastic. And at some point I want us to revisit The Invisible Man 2020, because I got a lot to say about that movie. A lot. good things. I actually really love that movie now, but holy crap. It was very stressful. I did not sleep last night.
It was very stressful.
And that was with a Unisom. It touched some trigger points for me. So,
yeah. It was a very stressful
movie. We need to revisit this. Maybe closer to Halloween, we can talk about some stuff and do like a mini episode or something.
Yeah.
We are eventually, one of these days, we're going to get to remakes and requels and all that.
So yeah. We'll get there. So definitely have me on that one. Do not let me miss that one, please.
Okay. Well, we're season by season, and we're actually... Eric, we've gone through a lot of our season one list, but we've been gonna this whole started because we were talking about Scream, because the new Scream had come out. We were like, you know, Scream was both kind of a re-entry point for me into horror and an entry point for Eric into horror, and we both just kind of discussing, you know, that in the first episode.
And so we kind of based our seasons around the Scream films individually, like in what they're kind of commenting on. So we went classic horror. You got to have a foundation, you know? So that's what we've been doing. And it's fun because Eric's introduced stuff into it that I didn't even expect to cover. And I've tried to throw some stuff in there that neither one of us have seen or that he hasn't seen or whatever. So it's been fun. But I'll let you know what our next episode will be, Eric. I haven't decided yet. I'm not gonna go super heavy. I'm gonna stick with the let's do some fun stuff for a couple. All right, man. But it's been good talking to you. We'll talk on, I'm sure we'll talk a lot through the week.
Yep, no problem. Y'all both have a good night.
You too. Bye.
Podcast Ask Us Many Questions. Who will listen and who will return next week? Who will take the time to rate and review? Check for a new episode of Photo Flow every week. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Photo Flow Terror and Instagram on Photo Flow _ Terror. Thank you for listening to Photo Flow. We'll find the terror in the smiles.